This is Audible.
Brought to you by Penguin. Apples Never Fall by Leanne Moriarty. Read by Caroline Lee.
Pan Macmillan acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to lands, waters, and communities. We pay our respect to elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. We honour more than 60,000 years of storytelling, art, and culture. The characters in this book are fictitious, and any resemblance to real persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental. The dedication reads, "For my mother, with love." Prologue. The bike lay on the side of the road beneath a grey oak, the handlebars at an odd, jutted angle, as if it had been thrown with angry force. It was early on a Saturday morning, the fifth day of a heatwave. More than 40 bushfires continued to blaze doggedly across the state. Six regional towns had evacuate now warnings in place, but here in suburban Sydney, the only danger was to asthma sufferers who were advised to stay indoors. The smoke haze that draped the city was a malicious yellow-grey, as thick as a London fog. The empty streets were silent, apart from the subterranean roar of cicadas. People slept after restless hot nights of jangled dreams, while early risers yawned and thumb-scrolled their phone screens. The discarded bike was shiny new, advertised as a vintage lady's bike. Mint green, 7-speed, with a tan leather saddle and a white wicker basket. The sort of bike you are meant to imagine riding in the cool, crisp air of a European mountain village, wearing a soft beret rather than a safety helmet, a baguette tucked under one arm. Four green apples lay scattered on the dry grass beneath the tree, as if they had spilled and rolled from the bike's basket. A family of black blowflies sat poised at different points on the bike's silver spokes, so still they looked dead. The car, a Holden Commodore V8, vibrated with the beat of 80s rock as it approached from the intersection, inappropriately fast in this family neighbourhood. The brake lights flashed and the car reversed with a squeal of tyres until it was parked next to the bike. The music stopped. The driver emerged, smoking a cigarette. He was skinny, barefoot, and bare-chested, wearing nothing but blue football shorts. He left the driver's door open and tiptoed with balletic, practiced grace across the already hot asphalt and onto the grass, where he hunkered down to study the bike. He caressed the bike's punctured front tyre as if it were the limb of a wounded animal. The flies buzzed, suddenly alive and worried. The man looked up and down the empty street, took a narrow-eyed drag of his cigarette, shrugged, and then grabbed the bike with one hand and stood. He walked to his car and laid it in his boot like a purchase, deftly popping off the front wheel with the quick-release lever to make it fit. He got back in the car, slammed the door shut, and drove off, rapping the beat to AC/DC's Highway to Hell on his steering wheel, pleased with himself. Yesterday had been Valentine's Day, apparently, and he didn't believe in that capitalist shit, but he was going to give the bike to his wife and say, "Happy late Valentine's Day, babe," with an ironic wink, and that would make up for the other day, and odds were he'd get lucky tonight. He didn't get lucky. He got very unlucky. 20 minutes later, he was dead, killed instantly in a head-on collision. A semi-trailer driver from interstate didn't see a stop sign concealed by an overgrown liquid amber. Local residents had been complaining for months about that sign. It was an accident waiting to happen, they said. And now it had happened. The apples rotted fast in the heat. Chapter 1. Two men and two women sat in the far corner of a cafe underneath the framed photo of sunflowers at dawn in Tuscany. They were basketball player tall, and as they leaned forward over the mosaic-topped round table, their foreheads almost touched. They spoke in low, intense voices, as if their conversation involved international espionage, which was incongruous in this small suburban cafe on a pleasant summery Saturday morning, with freshly baked banana and pear bread scenting the air and soft rock drifting languidly from the stereo to the accompaniment of the espresso machine's industrious hiss and grind. "I think they're brothers and sisters," said the waitress to her boss. The waitress was an only child and intrigued by siblings. "They look really similar." "They're taking too long to order," said her boss, who was one of eight and found siblings not at all intriguing. After last week's violent hailstorm, there had been blessed rain for nearly a week. Now the fires were under control, the smoke had cleared along with people's faces, and customers were finally out and about again, cash in hand. So they needed to be turning over tables fast. "They said they haven't had a chance to look at the menus." "Ask them again." The waitress approached the table once more, noting how they each sat in the same distinctive way, with their ankles hooked around the front legs of their chairs, as if to prevent them from sliding away. "Excuse me?" They didn't hear her. They were all talking at once, their voices overlapping. They were definitely related. They even sounded similar. Low, deep, husky-edged voices. People with sore throats and secrets. "She's not technically missing. She sent us that text. I just can't believe she's not answering her phone. She always answers. Dad mentioned her new bike is gone." "What? That's bizarre." "So she just cycled off down the street and into the sunset?"
"But she didn't take her helmet, which I find very weird."
"I think it's time we reported her missing." "It's over a week now. That's too long."
"Like I said, she's not technically. She is the very definition of missing because we don't know where she is."
The waitress raised her voice to a point that was perilously close to rude.
"Are you ready to order yet?"
They didn't hear her.
"Has anyone been over to the house yet?"
"Dad told me please don't come over. He said he's very busy." "Very busy? What's he so busy doing?" The waitress shuffled alongside them, in between the chairs and the wall, so that one of them might see her. "You know what could happen if we reported her missing?" The better looking of the two men spoke. He wore a long-sleeved linen shirt rolled up to the elbows, shorts and shoes without socks. He was in his early 30s, the waitress guessed, with a goatee and the low-level charismatic charm of a reality star or a real estate agent. They'd suspect Dad. "Suspect Dad of what?" asked the other man, a shabbier, chunkier, cheaper version of the first. Instead of a goatee, he just needed a shave.
"That he, you know."
The expensive version brother drew his finger across his neck. The waitress went very still. This was the best conversation she'd overheard since she'd started waitressing.
"Jesus, Troy," the cheaper version brother exhaled. "That's not funny."
The other man shrugged.
"The police will ask if they argued. Dad said they did argue." "But surely..."
"Maybe Dad did have something to do with it," said the youngest of the four, a woman wearing a short orange dress dotted with white daisies over a swimsuit tied at the neck. Her hair was dyed blue. The waitress coveted that exact shade. And it was tied back in a sticky, wet, tangled knot at her neck. There was a fine sheen of sandy sunscreen on her arms, as if she'd just that moment walked off the beach, even though they were at least a 40-minute drive from the coast.
"Maybe he snapped. Maybe he finally snapped."
"Stop it, both of you," said the other woman, who the waitress realized now was a regular. Extra large, extra hot, soy flat white. Her name was Brooke. Brooke with an E. They wrote customers' names on their coffee lids, and this woman had once pointed out, in a diffident but firm way, as if she couldn't help herself, that there should be an E at the end of her name. She was polite, but not chatty, and generally just a little stressed, like she already knew the day wasn't going to go her way. She paid with a $5 note and always left the 50-cent piece in the tip jar. She wore the same thing every day, a navy polo shirt, shorts and runners with socks. Today she was dressed for the weekend in a skirt and top, but she still had the look of an off-duty member of the armed forces or a PE teacher who wouldn't fall for any of your excuses about cramps. "Dad would never hurt Mum," she said to her sister. "Never!" "Oh my God, of course he wouldn't. I'm not serious." The blue-haired girl held up her hands, and the waitress saw the rumpled skin around her eyes and mouth and realized she wasn't young at all. She was just dressed young. She was a middle-aged person in disguise. From a distance, you'd guess 20. From close up, you'd think maybe 40. It felt like a trick. "Mum and Dad have a really strong marriage," said Brooke with an E. And something about the resentfully deferential pitch of her voice made the waitress think that in spite of her sensible clothes, she might be the youngest of the four. The better-looking brother gave her a quizzical look. "Did we grow up in the same house?" "I don't know. Did we? Because I never saw any signs of violence. I mean, God!" "Anyway, I'm not the one suggesting it. I'm saying other people might suggest it." The blue-haired woman looked up and caught sight of the waitress. "Sorry, we still haven't looked." She picked up the laminated menu. "That's okay," said the waitress. She wanted to hear more. "Also, we're all a bit distracted. Our mother is missing." "Oh no, that's worrying." The waitress couldn't quite work out how to react. They didn't seem that worried. These people were, like, all a lot older than her. Wouldn't their mother therefore be properly old? Like a little old lady? How did a little old lady go missing? Dementia? Brooke with an E winced. She said to her sister, "Don't tell people that." "I apologise. Our mother is possibly missing," amended the blue-haired woman. "We have temporarily mislaid our mother." "You need to retrace your steps," the waitress went along with the joke. "Where did you see her last?" There was an awkward pause. They all looked at her with identical liquid brown eyes and sober expressions. They all had the sort of eyelashes that were so dark they looked like they were wearing eyeliner. "You know, you're right. That's exactly what we need to do." The blue-haired woman nodded slowly, as if she were taking the flippant remark seriously. "Retrace our steps." "We'll all try the apple crumble with cream," interrupted the expensive version brother, "and then we'll let you know what we think." "Good one." The cheaper version brother tapped the edge of his menu on the side of the table. "For breakfast," said Brooke. But she smiled wryly, as if at some private joke related to apple crumble, and they all handed over their menus in the relieved, "that's sorted then" way that people handed back menus, glad to be rid of them. The waitress wrote 4x app crumb on her notepad and straightened the pile of menus. "Listen," said the cheaper version brother, "has anyone called her?" "Coffees?" asked the waitress. "We'll all have long blacks," said the expensive version brother, and the waitress made eye contact with Brooke with an E to give her the chance to say, "No, actually, that's not my coffee. I always have an extra large, extra hot soy flat white." But she was busy turning on her brother. "Of course we've called her a million times. I've texted, I've emailed. Haven't you?" "So 4 long blacks?" said the waitress. No one responded. Okay, so four long blacks. Not mum, her. The cheaper version brother put his elbows on the table and pressed his fingertips to his temples. Savannah, has anyone tried to get in contact with her? The waitress had no more excuses to linger and eavesdrop. Was Savannah another sibling? Why wasn't she here today? Was she the family outcast, the prodigal daughter? Is that why her name seemed to land between them with such portentousness? And had anyone called her? The waitress walked to the counter, hit the bell with the flat of her hand, and slapped down their order. Chapter 2. Last September. It was close to 11 on a chilly, breezy Tuesday night. Pale pink cherry blossoms skittered and whirled as the taxi drove slowly past renovated period homes, each with a mid-range luxury sedan in the driveway and an orderly trio of different coloured wheelie bins at the curb. A ring-tailed possum scuttled across a sandstone fence, caught in the taxi's headlights. A small dog yelped once and went quiet. The air smelled of wood smoke, cut grass, and slow-cooked lamb. Most of the houses were dark, except for the vigilant winking of security cameras. Joy Delaney, at number 9, packed her dishwasher while she listened to the latest episode of the Migraine Guy podcast on the fancy new wireless headphones her son had given her for her birthday. Joy was a tiny, trim, energetic woman with shiny shoulder-length white hair. She could never remember if she was 68 or 69, and sometimes she even allowed the possibility that she was 67. She was 69. Right now, she wore jeans and a black cardigan over a striped T-shirt with woolly socks. She supposedly looked great for her age. Young people in shops often told her this. She always wanted to say, "You don't know my age, you darling idiot, so how do you know I look great for it?" Her husband, Stan Delaney, sat in his recliner in the living room, an ice pack on each knee, watching a documentary about the world's greatest bridges while he worked his way through a packet of sweet chili crackers, dipping each one into a tub of cream cheese. Their elderly Staffordshire Terrier, Steffi, named after Steffi Graf, because as a puppy she'd been quick on her feet, sat on the kitchen floor next to Joy, chewing surreptitiously on a fragment of newspaper. Over the last year, Steffi had begun obsessively chewing on any paper she could find in the house, which was apparently a psychological condition in dogs, possibly brought on by stress, although no one knew what Steffi had to be stressed about. At least Steffi's paper habit was more acceptable than that of her neighbour Caro's cat, Otis, who had begun pilfering clothing from homes in the cul-de-sac, including, mortifyingly, underwear, which Caro was too embarrassed to return, except to Joy, of course. Joy knew her giant headphones made her resemble an alien, but she didn't care. After years of begging her children for quiet, she now couldn't endure it. The silence howled through her so-called empty nest. Her nest had been empty for many years, so she should have been used to it. But last year they'd sold their business, and it felt like everything ended, juddered to a stop. In her search for noise, she'd become addicted to podcasts. Often she went to bed with her headphones still on so she could be rocked to sleep by the lullaby of a chatty, authoritative voice. She didn't suffer from migraines herself, but her youngest daughter did, and Joy listened to the Migraine Guy podcast, both for informative tips she might be able to pass on to Brooke, and also as a kind of penance. Over recent years, she had come to feel almost sick with regret for the dismissive, impatient way she'd first responded to Brooke's childhood headaches, as they used to call them. Regret can be my memoir's theme, she thought, as she tried to shove the cheese grater into the dishwasher next to the fry pan. A Regretful Life by Joy Delaney. Last night she'd been to the first session of a So You Want to Write a Memoir course at the local evening college. Joy didn't want to write a memoir, but Caro did, so she was keeping her company. Caro was widowed and shy and didn't want to go on her own. Joy would help Caro make a friend. She already had her eye on someone suitable, and then she'd drop out. Their teacher had explained that you began the process of writing a memoir by choosing a theme, and then it was simply a case of finding anecdotes to support the theme. Maybe your theme is, "I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, but look at me now," the teacher said. And all the ladies in their tailored pants and pearl earrings nodded solemnly and wrote "wrong side of the tracks" in their brand new notebooks. "Well, at least your memoir's theme is obvious," Caro told Joy on the way home. "Is it?" said Joy. "It's tennis. Your theme is tennis." "That's not a theme," said Joy. "A theme is more like revenge, or success against the odds, or you could call it game, set and match, the story of a tennis family." "But that's, we're not tennis stars," said Joy. "We just ran a tennis school and a local tennis club. We're not the Williams family." For some reason, she found Caro's comment annoying, even upsetting. Caro looked astonished. "What are you talking about? Tennis is your family's passion. People are always saying, follow your passion." And I think to myself, oh, if only I had a passion, like Joy. Joy had changed the subject. Now she looked up from the dishwasher and remembered Troy as a young boy standing right here in this very kitchen, racket gripped like a weapon, face rosy with rage, his beautiful brown eyes full of blame and tears he would not let himself cry, shouting, "I hate tennis!" "Ooh, sacrilege," Amy had said, because her role as the oldest child was to narrate every family argument and use big words the other kids didn't understand, while Brooke, still little and adorable, had burst into inevitable tears, and Logan's face became blank and moronic. "You don't hate tennis," Joy had told him. It was an order. She had meant, "You can't hate tennis, Troy." She'd meant, "I don't have the time or the strength to let you hate tennis." Joy gave her head a little shake to dislodge the memory and tried to return her attention to the podcast. "Zigzag lines that float across your field of vision, shimmering spots or stars. People who have migraine aura symptoms say that..." Troy hadn't really hated tennis. Some of their happiest family memories were on the court. Most of their happiest memories. Some of their worst memories were on the court too. But come on now, Troy still played. If he'd really hated tennis, he wouldn't still be playing in his 30s. Was tennis her life's theme? Maybe Caro was right. She and Stan might never have met if not for tennis. More than half a century ago now, a birthday party in a small crowded house, heads bounced in time to Popcorn by Hot Butter. 18-year-old Joy gripped the chunky green stem of her wine glass, which was filled to the brim with warm Moselle. "Where's Joy? You should meet Joy. She just won some big tournament." Those were the words that unfastened the tight semicircle of people surrounding the boy with his back against the wall. He was a giant, freakishly tall and big-shouldered, with a mass of long, curly black hair tied back in a ponytail, a cigarette in one hand, a can of beer in the other. Athletic boys could still smoke like chimneys in the 70s. He had a dimple that only made an appearance when he saw Joy.
"We should have a hit sometime," he said.
She'd never heard a voice like it, not from a boy of her own generation. It was a voice so deep and slow, people made fun of it and tried to imitate it. They said Stan sounded like Johnny Cash. He didn't do it on purpose. It was just the way he spoke. He didn't speak much, but everything he said sounded important. They weren't the only tennis players at that party, just the only champions. It was destiny, as inevitable as a fairy tale. If they hadn't met that night, they would have met eventually. Tennis was a small world. They played their first match that weekend. She lost 6-4, 6-4, and then went right ahead and lost her virginity to him, even though her mother had warned her about the importance of withholding sex if she ever liked a boy. "Why buy a cow when you can get the milk for free?" Her daughters shrieked when they heard that phrase. Joy told Stan she only went to bed with him because of his serve. It was a magnificent serve. She still admired it, waiting for that split second when time stopped and Stan became a sculpture of a tennis player, back arched, ball suspended, racket behind his head, and then wham! Stan said he only went to bed with her because of her decisive volley. And then he said, that deep, slow voice in her ear, "No, that's not true. Your volley needs work. You crowd the net. I went to bed with you because as soon as I saw those legs, I knew I wanted them wrapped around my back." And Joy swooned. She thought that was so wicked and poetic, although she did not appreciate the criticism of her volley. This causes the release of neurotransmitters. She looked at the grater. It was covered in carrot, which the dishwasher wouldn't wash off. She rinsed it in the sink. "Why am I doing your job for you?" she said to the dishwasher, and thought of herself in pre-dishwasher days, standing at this sink, rubber gloves in hot dishwater, a skyscraper of dirty plates by her side. Her past kept bumping up against her present lately. Yesterday she'd woken from a nap in a panic, thinking she'd forgotten to pick up one of the children from school. It took her a good minute to remember that all of her children were adults now. Adults with wrinkles and mortgages, degrees and travel plans. It made her wonder if she had dementia. Her friend, Linda, who worked at a nursing home, said a wave of restlessness swept through the place at school pickup time each day as the elderly ladies became agitated, convinced they should be rushing to collect long-since grown children. Hearing that had made Joy teary, and now the exact same thing had kind of happened to her. "It's possible my superior intellect is masking my dementia symptoms," Joy had told Stan.
"Can't say I've noticed," said Stan.
"My dementia symptoms or my superior intellect?"
"Well, you've always been demented," he'd said,
and then wandered off, probably to climb a ladder, because his sons had informed him that 70 was too old to climb ladders, so he liked to find excuses to climb them as often as possible. Last night, she'd listened to a very informative podcast called This Dementia Life. The cheese grater refused to join the fry pan in the dishwasher. She studied the two items. It felt like a puzzle she should be able to solve.
"Trigger a change in the size of the blood vessels," said the migraine guy.
What? She was going to have to rewind this podcast and start again. She'd heard that retirement caused a rapid decline in brain function. Maybe that's what was going on here. Her frontal lobe was atrophying. They had thought they were ready to retire. Selling the tennis school had seemed like the obvious next step in their lives. They couldn't keep coaching forever, and none of their children were interested in taking on the business. In fact, they were insultingly disinterested. For years, Stan had nursed a wild hope that Logan might buy into Delaney's, that old-fashioned idea of the eldest son becoming his proud successor. "Logan was a great coach," he'd mutter. He got it. He really got it. Paul Logan had looked completely aghast when Stan had diffidently suggested he might like to buy the business. "He's not very driven, is he?" Stan had remarked to Joy, and Joy had snapped at him because she couldn't bear to hear criticism of her children, especially when that criticism was valid. So they sold up, to good people for a good price. She hadn't anticipated this sense of loss. She hadn't realised how much they were defined by Delaney's Tennis Academy. Who were they now? Just another pair of boomers. Thank God for their own tennis. Their most recent trophy sat, heavy and proud, on the sideboard, ready to show off when everyone was together on Father's Day. Stan's knees were paying for it now, but it had been a good solid win over two technically excellent players. She and Stan had held the net, attacked the middle, and never lost their cool. They still had it. In addition to tournaments, they still played in the Monday night social comp that Joy had established years ago, although that had recently got depressing because people kept dying. 6 months ago, Dennis Christos had died on the court while he and his wife Debbie played against Joy and Stan, which had been terribly traumatic. Joy believed poor Dennis's heart couldn't take the excitement of thinking he was going to break Stan's serve. She secretly blamed Stan for making Dennis think it was a possibility. He deliberately let the game get to 40 love for his own pleasure. It was taking a lot of willpower for her not to say, "You killed Dennis Christos, Stan." The truth was, she and Stan weren't suited to retirement. Their 6-week dream holiday to Europe had been a disaster. Even Wimbledon, especially Wimbledon. When the plane landed back in Sydney, they'd both been giddy with relief, and they'd admitted that to no one. Not to their friends or their children. Not even to each other. Sometimes they tried to do things that their other retired friends did, like a lovely day at the beach, for example. Joy cut her foot to shreds standing on an oyster shell, and they got a parking ticket. It had reminded her of those occasions when she had got it into her head that she and Stan would take the children on a lovely picnic, and she'd tried so hard to pretend they were a lovely picnicking family, but something inevitably went wrong. There was always someone in a bad mood, or they got lost, or it rained just as they arrived, and the drive home was silent and resentful, except for the regular sniffles of whichever child felt he or she had been unjustifiably admonished. "We've actually become quite romantic since retirement," one annoyingly chipper friend told her, which made Joy want to gag. But the other week, she bought 2 banana milkshakes at the food court as a kind of fun gesture because she and Stan used to buy them for breakfast at small-town milk bars when they used to travel together for regional tournaments in the early years of their marriage. They'd save on motels by sleeping in the car. They had sex in the back seat. But it was clear that Stan didn't even remember their banana milkshakes, and then on the way home he dramatically and unnecessarily slammed on the brakes when someone pulled out in front of them and Joy's milkshake went flying. So their car now permanently and disgustingly smelled of sour milk, the sour smell of failure. Stan said he couldn't smell a thing. They needed different personalities to retire with grace and verve like their friends. They needed to be less grumpy, Stan did, and have a wider variety of interests and hobbies beyond tennis. They needed grandchildren. Grandchildren! The word alone filled her with the kind of giant, complicated emotions reserved for the young. Desire, fury, and worst of all, spiteful, bitter envy. She knew one tiny grandchild was all it would take to stop the silence roaring, to make her days splatter back to life again. But you could not ask your children for grandchildren. How demeaning, how ordinary. She believed herself to be more interesting and sophisticated than that. She was a feminist, an athlete, a very successful businesswoman. She refused to be that particular cliche. It would happen. She just had to be patient. She had four children, four tickets in the raffle, although two of her four children were single, so perhaps they didn't count as tickets just yet. But two were in solid long-term relationships. Logan and his girlfriend Indira had been together for 5 years now. They weren't married, but that didn't matter. Indira was wonderful, and the last time Joy saw her, she definitely had a mysterious, secretive look about her, almost as if she wanted to tell Joy something but was holding off. Maybe until she got to 12 weeks? Brooke and Grant were happily married, settled with a mortgage on a proper house and a family car, and Grant was older, so it could be on the cards soon. If only Brooke hadn't opened up her own physiotherapy practice. It was admirable. Stan glowed with pride whenever anyone mentioned it. But running your own business was stressful, and migraine sufferers had to manage their stress. Brooke was too driven. But surely she'd want a baby soon. Brooke always knew the latest medical guidelines, so she would know you shouldn't leave it too late. Joy secretly hoped her children might find a creative way to tell her about their pregnancies, like other people's children were always doing on YouTube. They could, for example, wrap up an ultrasound picture and then film Joy's reaction as she opened it. Bewilderment followed by understanding, hand clapped across her mouth, tears and hugs. They could post it on their social media. Joy finds out she's going to be a grandma. It might go viral. Joy dressed extra nicely every time her children visited, just in case. She would never share that fantasy with anyone, not even the dog. The migraine guy spoke seductively into Joy's ears.
"Let's talk about magnesium."
"Good idea. Let's do that," said Joy. There was no way for the fry pan and grater to fit together. There was no solution. The grater would have to miss out. It was clean anyway. She straightened up from the dishwasher to discover her husband standing right in front of her, like he'd teleported himself. "Jesus! Bloody! What the?" she shrieked. She pushed her headphones down onto her neck and put her hand to her thumping heart. "Don't creep up on me like that!"
"Why is someone knocking on the door?"
Stan's lips were orange from the chili crackers. There were damp circles on the knees of his jeans from the melting ice packs. It was aggravating just to look up at him, especially because he was looking down at her with an accusing expression, as if the knock on the door was her fault. Steffi sat herself down next to Stan, ears pricked and alert, eyes shining with the glorious possibility of a walk. Joy's eyes went to the clock on the kitchen wall. It was far too late for a delivery or a market researcher, too late for a friend or family member to drop by, and no one really did that anymore, not without calling first. Joy considered her husband. Maybe he was the one with dementia. She knew from her research that the spouse must be patient and kind. "I didn't hear anything," she said patiently and kindly. She would be an excellent carer, although she might waitlist him at a nice nursing home sooner rather than later. "I heard a knock," insisted Stan, and his jaw shifted back and forth in that way that indicated annoyance. But then Joy heard it too. Thump, thump, thump. Like someone banging a closed fist on their front door. Their doorbell had been broken for years, and people often knocked impatiently after they gave up on the bell. But this had the quality of an emergency. Her eyes met Stan's, and without saying a word, they both headed for the front door, not running, but walking fast down the long hallway. Quick, quick, quick. Steffi trotted along beside them, panting with excitement. Joy's socks slipped on the floorboards, and she felt that all three of them, man, woman, and dog, shared an invigorating sense of urgency. They were needed. There must be a crisis of some sort. They would fix the crisis, because even though there were no children living at home, they still had that mindset. We are the grown-ups. We are the fixers. Maybe there was even pleasure in that rapid walk to the door, because it had been a while since any of the children had asked for money or advice or even a lift to the airport. Bang, bang, bang. Coming, called out Stan. Fragments of memories flashed through Joy's mind. Troy arriving home from school when he was around 8 or 9, hammering on the door and hollering, FBI, open up! He did this for years every time he came to a door, thought he was so funny. Amy frantically ringing the bell back when it worked because she'd lost her house key yet again and was always in a hurry to get to the bathroom. Stan got there ahead of her. He click-clacked the deadlock with an efficient twist of his wrist and threw open the door. A sobbing young woman lurched forward as though she'd been resting her forehead on the door and fell straight into Stan's arms, like a daughter. Chapter 3.
Hello there, said Stan, stunned.
He clumsily patted her shoulder. For the first fraction of a second, Joy assumed it was one of their daughters, but this girl barely came up to Stan's chest. Joy's children were tall. The boys were 6'4", Amy was 6', and Brooke was 6'1". They were all broad-shouldered, dark-haired, olive-skinned, scarlet-cheeked, and dimpled, like their father.
Your children all look like giant Spanish matadors, Joy's mother used to say, chidingly, as if Joy had picked them off a shelf.
This girl was petite, with straggly, dirty blonde hair and blue-veined, mottled white skin. I'm sorry. The girl stood back, took a shuddery breath, sniffed and tried to arrange her mouth into the shape of a smile. I'm so sorry. How embarrassing. She had a fresh, deep cut just beneath her right eyebrow. Trails of shiny, wet blood trickled down her face. It's fine, darling. Joy took a firm hold of the girl's stick-thin upper arm in case she fainted. She would call her darling until she remembered her name. Stan would be no help. She could sense his eyes trying to meet hers. Who the heck is this? The girl had a tiny seed-like piercing in her nose and a tattoo of a green vine curled around her pale forearm. She wore a threadbare long-sleeved shirt with a spatter of old grease stains on the front and ripped blue jeans. There was a silver key on a chain around her neck. Her bare feet were purple with cold. She was vaguely, blurrily, not quite familiar. It would be helpful if the girl said her name, but young people always assumed that they'd be remembered. It happened all the time. A young stranger would make a beeline for them, waving delightedly. Mr. and Mrs. Delaney, how are you? It's been ages. Joy would have to bluff her way through the conversation while simultaneously flicking through her mental database. A tennis kid? A club member's grown-up child? One of the children's friends?
What happened to you?
Stan gestured at the girl's eye. He looked frightened, suddenly elderly.
Is someone out there?
He peered over her shoulder onto the street. It would never have occurred to Joy that there would be someone out there. There's no one out there, said the girl. I came in a cab. It's okay, sweetheart. We'll get you fixed up, said Joy. This was very confusing, but it would all become clear. Stan always wanted everything instantly clarified. Joy guessed the girl to be in her late 20s, the same age as Brooke. But she didn't look like one of Brooke's friends, who were busy, polite young women with a lot on their minds. This girl had the grungy look that Amy favoured, so it seemed most likely she was one of Amy's friends. This made it difficult because Amy moved in a variety of eclectic circles. Someone from that amateur theatre group Amy had been so enthusiastic about for at least a week? A university friend? From her first abandoned degree? Second? "How did you hurt yourself?" asked Joy. "My boyfriend and I got in an argument," said the girl. She swayed and pressed the heel of her hand to her bloody eye. "I just ran out of the apartment onto the street and jumped in a cab."
"Your boyfriend did this to you?" said Stan. "You mean he hit you?"
"Sort of," said the girl.
"Sort of? What does that mean?" said Stan. The man could be so abrasive at times. "Did he hit you or not?"
"It's complicated," said the girl.
"No, it's not. If you've been assaulted, we should call the police," said Stan.
"No," the girl shifted from Joy's grip. "No way. I don't want the police involved." "We don't need to call the police, darling, not if you don't want," said Joy. "It's your choice. But come and sit down." If the girl didn't want to call the police, then that was fine with her. She didn't want police here. As they passed under one of the hallway downlights, Joy saw that the girl was older than she'd first thought. Maybe her early 30s. Think. Could she be one of the boy's ex-girlfriends? There had been a few years where it had been hard to keep track of all the young girls sashaying about their house. Both boys had long-term relationships with tanned blonde girls in white sneakers called Tracy. Stan could never tell which Tracy was which. Both Tracys ended up crying at Joy's kitchen table on separate occasions while Joy chopped onions and murmured comfortingly. Logan's Tracy still sent Christmas cards. But this girl didn't look like one of the girlfriends. Troy went for glossy princesses and Logan went for sexy librarians, and this girl was neither. "Then I realised I didn't have any money," said the girl as they walked into the kitchen. And she stopped and tipped back her head to study the high ceiling as if it were a cathedral. Joy followed her gaze as it travelled around the room to the sideboard crammed with framed family photos and ornaments, including the pair of horrible, sneering china cats that had belonged to Stan's mother, and lingered on the bowl of fresh fruit sitting on the table, shiny red apples and bright yellow bananas. Was the child hungry? She was welcome to all the bananas. Joy didn't know why she kept buying them. It was as if they were for display purposes only. Most ended up mushy, soft and black, and then she felt ashamed throwing them away. "I was just completely empty-handed. No wallet, no phone, no money, nothing." "Sit down, darling." Joy pulled out a chair at the kitchen table. Stan had stopped barking questions, thank goodness. He silently took down the first aid kit from its place in the cupboard above the refrigerator where Joy couldn't reach it without standing on a chair. He put it on the table and opened the lid because Joy always struggled with the stiff lock. Then he went to the sink and got the girl a glass of water. "Let's take a look at this." Joy put on her glasses. "Is it very painful?" "Oh, it's fine. I have a high pain threshold." The girl lifted the glass of water with a shaky hand and drank. Her fingernails were ragged. A nail biter. Amy used to be a terrible nail biter. The chill of the cold night air radiated off the girl's skin as Joy cleaned the wound with antiseptic. "So you realised you didn't have your purse?" prompted Joy as Stan sat down, put his elbows on the tabletop, clasped his hands together and rubbed his nose against his knuckles, frowning heavily. Yeah, so I was freaking out, thinking, how am I going to pay the fare? And the driver wasn't one of those friendly cabbies, you know? I could just tell. He looked like he could be the type to be mean, even aggressive. So we were just driving randomly and...
Driving randomly? Interrupted Stan. But what destination did you give the driver when you got in the cab?
Joy shot him a look. Sometimes he didn't realize how he could come across to people. I didn't give him an address. I wasn't thinking. I said, head north. I was trying to buy myself time while I worked out where to go.
Did the driver not even notice you were hurt? Asked Joy.
He should have taken you straight to the nearest hospital without charging you a cent. If he did notice, he didn't want to know about it.
Joy shook her head sadly. People these days.
But anyway, then, for some reason, I don't know why, something made me do it. I put my hand in the pocket of my jeans and I couldn't believe it. I pulled out a $20 note. It was so random. I never find money like that.
The girl's face lit up with childlike pleasure as she remembered the moment she'd found the money.
Someone was looking out for you, said Joy. She cut a piece of gauze from the roll. Yeah, I know. So as the fare got closer to $20, I started giving the cabbie random directions, like turn left, second right. I don't know. I was kind of delirious. I was just following my nose. Wait, did I make that up? Following your nose. It sounds funny now I say it. How do you follow your nose?
The girl looked up at Joy.
No, that's right, said Joy. She tapped her own nose. Following your nose. She looked over at Stan. He was pulling on his lower lip the way he did when he disapproved of something. He never followed his nose anywhere.
You need a game plan, kid. You don't just hit the ball and hope to win. You plan how you're going to win.
The moment the fare clicked over to $20, I shouted, stop! And I just got out of the car. It's so cold outside tonight, I didn't realize.
The girl shivered convulsively.
And I've got bare feet.
She lifted her dirty foot and pointed at her toes.
I was just standing there in the gutter. My feet felt like blocks of ice. I thought, you idiot, you stupid, stupid idiot, what now? And then I started to feel dizzy and I looked at the houses and yours seemed the friendliest and the lights were on, so...
She tugged on the sleeves of her shirt.
So here I am.
Joy paused, the gauze mid-air.
So are you saying we don't, you don't?
She tried to think of a more elegant way to put it, but couldn't.
You don't know us?
She saw now that she'd been kidding herself, thinking the girl was familiar. She was only familiar in the way everyone seemed familiar these days. They'd just let a stranger into the house. She checked for signs of criminal tendencies and found none, although she wasn't exactly sure how those tendencies would manifest themselves. The nose stud was really quite pretty. Amy had the most dreadful lip piercing a few years back, so Joy wasn't too concerned by a nose piercing. A tattoo of a leafy green vine wasn't exactly intimidating. She seemed fine. A bit flaky, perhaps, but she was sweet. This girl couldn't be dangerous. She was too small. As dangerous as a mouse.
You didn't have any friends or family you could go to? Asked Stan.
Joy gave him another look. It was true she wanted to ask the same question, but there had to be a nicer way.
We've only just moved down here from the Gold Coast, said the girl. I don't know a single person in Sydney.
Imagine, thought Joy.
You're all alone, without money, in a strange city, and you can't go back home. What can you do except throw yourself on the mercy of strangers? She couldn't imagine herself in the same situation. She had always been cushioned by people. Stan said, "Do you maybe want to call someone? Your family?"
"There isn't really anyone available right now."
The girl lowered her head so that Joy could see her poor, defenceless, thin white neck between the clumpy strands of her hair.
"Look up at me, darling."
Joy pressed the gauze over the cut. "Finger there." She guided the girl's hand to the gauze, taped it in place with a strip of adhesive, and sighed with satisfaction. "There you go. All fixed."
"Thank you."
The girl looked at Joy with clear, pale green eyes, framed by the fairest eyelashes Joy had ever seen. They looked like they'd been dusted with gold. Joy's children all had those dark matador eyelashes. Joy herself had very ordinary eyelashes. The girl was unexpectedly pretty now that the blood had been cleared up. So pretty, and so very skinny and dirty and tired. Joy felt an overwhelming desire to feed her, run her a bath, and put her to bed.
"I'm Savannah," said the girl,
and she held out her hand for Joy to shake.
"Savannah? That's a pretty name," said Joy. "I have a friend called Hannah. Quite similar. Well, not that similar. Savannah. Where do I know that name from? I know. I think Princess Anne has a granddaughter called Savannah. She's a cute little girl, a bit wicked. I don't think she's Princess Savannah. I don't think she has a title at all. Not that you'd be interested in that. I've just always had a special interest in the royal family. I follow them on Instagram." She couldn't seem to stop talking. It happened when she felt upset or shocked, and she realised that she possibly did feel a little upset and shocked right now by the blood and the story of violence she'd just heard. She saw she was still holding the girl's small, icy cold hand and gave it a quick, comforting squeeze before releasing it. "There's another Savannah I'm thinking of, besides the royal one. I'm sure there is. Oh, I know. My youngest daughter, Brooke, has a friend who just had a baby, and I'm 90% sure she called her Savannah. Or it could have been Samantha."
She remembered the baby's name was actually Poppy, which was nothing at all like Savannah or Samantha, so that was embarrassing, but no need to mention it. Brooke herself isn't ready to have a baby yet because she started her own physiotherapy practice, which is exciting. Not exciting at all. Infuriating. But as her grandfather used to say, never spoil a good story with the facts. She's very busy focusing on that. It's called Delaney's Physiotherapy. I have a card somewhere. She's really very good. Brooke, I mean. My daughter. Very calm and patient. It's interesting because we never thought...
"Joy," interrupted Stan. "Take a breath."
"We never thought we'd have anyone medical in our family."
Joy trailed off. She put her hand to her neck and felt the headphones that were still sitting there like a giant statement necklace.
"I was listening to a podcast," she explained idiotically.
In fact, she could hear the tinny, disembodied voice of her podcast host, still chatting obliviously on, unaware that Joy was no longer listening.
"I like podcasts," said Savannah. "We never said our names. I'm Joy."
Joy switched the headphones off and put them on the table. "And this is my grumpy husband, Stan."
"Thank you for fixing me up, Joy." Savannah gestured at her bandaged face. "Even though you're not a medical family, I think you did a tip-top job."
Tip-top. What a funny word. A blast from the past.
"Oh, well, thank you," said Joy. "I never... well,
She made herself stop talking.
I had a good feeling about this house. Savannah looked around her. As soon as I saw it, it just felt very warm and safe.
It is safe, said Joy. She avoided looking at her husband.
Would you like something to eat, Savannah? Are you hungry? Have a banana, or I have leftovers from dinner I could heat up.
She didn't give the girl time to accept the offer before she rushed into the next.
And then you'll stay the night, of course.
She was so glad her cleaning lady, good old Barb, had been today, and that together they'd vacuumed and dusted Amy's old bedroom.
Ah, said Savannah.
She looked uneasily over at Stan and then back again at Joy.
I don't know about that. I could just...
But it was clear there was nowhere else for her to go at this time of night, and there was no way in the world that Joy was sending this tiny barefoot girl back out into the cold. Chapter 4. Now. We're trying to track down that girl who stayed with Mum and Dad last year. The beauty therapist, dressed in immaculate white, knelt at her client's enormous feet as she gently guided them into a foot bath filled with warm, scented water, floating rose petals and smooth, oval-shaped pebbles manufactured to look like they had come from a mountain stream. She turned up on their doorstep late one night. The client, who was booked in for the deluxe power pedicure, a luxury experience for the busy executive, wiggled his feet against the stones and kept talking, fortunately at an acceptable volume. He'd politely asked the beauty therapist if she minded if he made some calls while he had his pedicure. Most people just started randomly shouting. "She's probably got nothing to do with it," he said. "We're just calling everyone Mum knows." The client's phone was in the pocket of his slouchy, soft white shirt. He wore AirPods. The therapist's dad said people wearing AirPods looked like peanuts. Her dad had recently turned 50, and it was cute the way he thought his opinions still had value. The client didn't look like a peanut. He was very attractive. "It's just strange for Mum not to be in touch for this long. Normally she calls me back within 2 minutes, all breathless and horrified that she missed the call." The beauty therapist scrubbed apricot kernel exfoliator into the heel of his right foot in hard, vigorous circles. "I know, but it's not like she disappeared without a word. She texted us all on Valentine's Day." He paused. "I'll tell you exactly what it said. Hold on a sec." He scrolled through his phone with his thumb. "Here it is." He read out loud. "Going off grid for a little while. I'm dancing daffodils, 21, dog champagne to end Czechoslovakia. Spangle moot. Love, Mum. Heart emoji, butterfly emoji, flower emoji, smiley face emoji. Off grid was in capitals." The beauty therapist's mother used a lot of emojis in her texts too. Mothers loved emojis. She wondered what all that dancing daffodils stuff could possibly mean. "It just means she was texting without her glasses," said the client to the person on the phone, who must have been wondering the same thing. "Her texts are always filled with weird random phrases." The beauty therapist tried to massage his calf muscle. It was like trying to massage granite. He must be a runner. "Yeah," he said. "I'm going over there now to talk to Dad to see if I can find out more. Not that he'll tell me anything." At that moment, his foot gave a sudden spasm. The toes splayed at an unnatural angle. "Cramp!" he cried. The beauty therapist swerved her head just in the nick of time. Chapter 5. Last September. Joy closed their bedroom door with a gentle apologetic click, as if Savannah would overhear and know they were only closing it because she was there. They had always slept with their door wide open throughout their married life, so that small, anxious children could hurtle straight into their bed after nightmares, so that they could hear teenagers crashing through the house, drunk but thankfully home alive, so that they could rush to administer medication, advice, comfort, so that they could leap from their beds each morning and run straight into the action of their busy, important lives. Once, closing the bedroom door had been a signal that someone thought sex might be a good idea. Now it was a signal that they had a guest, an unexpected guest. Savannah was hopefully warm and comfortable in Amy's old bedroom, wearing an old pair of Amy's pyjamas. Amy, their eldest, their free spirit, as Joy liked to call her, their problem child, as Stan liked to call her, was turning 40 next year, and she hadn't officially lived at home for 2 decades, but she still used her old bedroom as a kind of permanent storage unit because she never seemed to settle at one address long enough to properly relocate her possessions. It was, admittedly, strange behaviour for a nearly 40-year-old, and there had been a time when Joy and Stan had talked about putting their foot down, and friends had suggested they should do so, as if it were possible to use sheer force of will to mould Amy into a regular person. Amy was Amy, and right now she had a job and a phone number, her fingernails were generally clean, and her hair, albeit currently dyed blue, did not look like it was crawling with lice, and that was all Joy wanted from her, although it would be nice if she combed her hair occasionally. "Is she in bed?" asked Dan as he came out of the bathroom, wearing boxers and a V-necked white T-shirt, from which sprang white chest hair. He was still a big, muscly, overbearing man, but he always looked vulnerable to Joy in his pyjamas. "I think so," said Joy. "She seemed sleepy after her bath." She had insisted on running a bath for Savannah. The taps were tricky to manage. She'd added some of the peach-scented bubble bath someone had given her for Mother's Day and laid out 2 of the fluffiest guest towels she could find. And it had been so pleasing to see Savannah come out of the bathroom, pink-cheeked and yawning, the tips of her hair wet, Amy's dressing gown trailing on the floor behind her. Joy could hear the rounded notes of contentment in her voice. It was the long-ago primal satisfaction of feeding and bathing a hungry, tired, compliant child and then tucking that clean, pyjama-clad child straight into bed. Amy's dressing gown was so long. Joy stopped. "What the heck?" Her mouth dropped. "Oh, my word," she said. "You didn't." A pile of random objects was crammed, higgledy-piggledy, on top of their chest of drawers. Stan's ancient laptop that she was pretty sure was broken, her iPad that she never touched, their desktop computer, including the monitor, their 10-year-old television, a calculator, and an old jar of 20-cent coins that probably had a total value of $10, if that. "I'm just being cautious," said Stan defensively. "We don't know anything about her. She could rob us blind in the night and we'd feel like real dickheads calling the police in the morning. Oh, yes, that's right, officer. We fed her dinner, ran her a bubble bath, put her to bed, and, lo and behold, we woke up this morning and all our worldly possessions have gone." "I can't believe you crept around the house unplugging all our worldly possessions." She ran her fingers over the snarl of dusty electrical cords that dangled off the chest of drawers. Oh, my Lord, there was his precious laminator, which Troy got him last Christmas, thus beginning Stan's obsession with laminating anything he could find. Instructions for using the TV remote, admittedly helpful, the article in the local paper about the sale of Delaney's, inspiring sporting quotes he printed out from the internet and wanted to remember. He'd laminate joy if he got the chance.
Wait, is that the DVD player? Stan, she wouldn't take the DVD player. No one uses DVD players anymore.
We do, said Stan.
People her age don't watch DVDs, said Joy. They all stream.
You don't even know what streaming means, said Stan.
I do so, said Joy. She went into the bathroom to clean her teeth. It's just watching Netflix on TV, isn't it? Isn't that what streaming means?
He had no right to pretend he had superior knowledge about technology. He was a man who didn't own a mobile phone as a matter of principle and stubborn pride. He loved it when people were shocked to discover he had never owned one, never would own one. He truly believed it made him morally superior, which drove Joy bananas because, excuse me, he was not. The way he talked about his stance on mobile phones, you would think he were the lone person in the crowd not giving the Nazi salute. Before their retirement, he told people, I don't need a phone. I'm a tennis coach, not a surgeon. There are no tennis emergencies. There were so tennis emergencies, and more than once over the years she'd been furious when she couldn't contact him, and she was left in a tricky situation that would have been instantly solved if he'd owned a phone. Also, his principles didn't prevent him from happily picking up the landline and calling Joy on her mobile when she was at the shops to ask how much longer she'd be or to please buy more chili crackers. But when Stan was gone, he was gone. And if she thought about that too much and all it implied, she could tap into a great well of rage. So she didn't think about it. That was the secret of a happy marriage. Step away from the rage. She put on her nicest pajamas, seeing as there was a guest in the house, and hopped into bed next to Stan. Her movements felt theatrical, as if she were being observed. They lay in silence for a few moments, flat on their backs, the quilt tucked under their elbows, like good children waiting for bedtime stories. The light was out, their lamps were on. There was a framed wedding